Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Farmer Joel Salatin doesn't just grow food, he has a food philosophy. He says it's time to reject the industrialized food system and get back to the earth. Get a little dirt under your fingers. Shop for local produce. Heat up the skillet, not the microwave, and get to know your food. The nation, he warns, has gone soft. And this ain't normal. This hour on Point, advice for a better world with Joel Salatin. Joining me now from Harrisonburg, Virginia, is farmer philosopher Joel Salatin. Called the High Priest of the Pasture by the New York Times, he's the owner of Polyface Farms in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, where he and his family have raised organic livestock for three generations. His new book is Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. Joel Salatin, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane. It's great to be with you.
So it's a great book title. Give us your thesis in a nutshell.
The thesis in a nutshell is that so many people today think that the way we live, modern Americans live, is actually normal. And my suggestion is that I think in the future we will look back on this basically 100-year blip of human history and say, wow, that was really abnormal.
So how would you describe your sense of quote-unquote normal? I mean, what separates your lifestyle and the one that you and your kids grew up with and the majority of America today?
Well, first of all, we actually have a large garden. We preserve food to eat in the wintertime, so we have several hundred quarts of food that mainly my wife cans in the summer. So when I go shopping, I go to the cellar and we store our potatoes, we store carrots. In other words, we grow most of our own food. We prepare it from, you know, totally raw state in the kitchen. And so all the food that we eat, we can pronounce. We're viscerally involved with it. And a lot of the food that we buy that we don't produce, we actually know the farmer that produces it. We go up 80 miles away to get all of our apple juice from a farm. I mean, we participate in that. We get our cheese. We participate in the local bioregional food economy very viscerally. And that's unusual.
So I'm hearing city folk far and wide saying, well, that's nice. That's Joel's choice. But, you know, I live in an apartment in the city and this is what I choose to do. I mean, gosh, that's Little House on the Prairie or the Waltons. But what, not for me?
Well, sure. And the point that I make in the book several times is that there is something for all of us to do. And the fact that so many people don't realize how far we have disconnected from our ecological womb, if you will. You know, we don't know how to prepare food. We don't know where food comes from. This is the first culture in history that has routinely eaten food that you can't pronounce. You know, have you ever tried making high fructose corn syrup in your kitchen? We've eaten food that you can't make in your kitchen. We're eating food that travels on average 1,500 miles between field and fork. I mean, this was never possible until cheap energy and long distance transportation. And the point is that if energy does become more expensive, if pathogenicity and food recalls do accelerate, which it appears that they are, if food becomes more sterile and less biological, if toxicity in our environment continue to increase due to concentrated animal feeding operations, pesticide and herbicide use, and transgenic modification adulteration, if those things proliferate, the chances are that our grandchildren will be returning to much of the normalcy that occupied generations prior to this, what I call this blip in human history.
The New York Times calls you, Joel, the High Priest of the Pasture, as I mentioned, Virginia's most multifaceted agrarian since Thomas Jefferson. What are you doing out there in Virginia on your farm that's caused such a stir in the farming industry?
Well, several things. One is that we do pasture our livestock. We do raise beef, pork, chicken, eggs and meat, and turkeys, rabbits, timber. You know, we're mainly a forest farm, have a lot of acreage in forestry. So we raise all these things, but we do it on pasture as opposed to confinement animal feeding operations, which means that the infrastructure, the shelters and infrastructure and management tools are all portable. And so essentially what we're trying to do is take nature's template and cut around it like a pattern and say, how do we approximate nature's template on a commercial domestic production model? In nature, animals are moving. Birds scratch. They fly. They move around. Herbivores are nature's pruners. They're the biomass accumulator restart button in nature. And so, you know, they're not eating dead cows like the USDA told us to feed for 40 years and gave us, you know, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. They're not eating chicken manure and chicken feathers and dead chickens like we're still feeding cattle in this country. They're not eating silage and grain. An herbivore is fundamentally a four-legged portable sauerkraut vat, you know, fermenting carbohydrates in forage like sauerkraut and turning it into meat and milk. And so we're using the animals in their historic normal occupation on the farm. Now,
so you've never bought a pound of chemical fertilizer. You don't use pesticides, herbicides, insecticides, the other sides that, you know, farmers, I guess, typically use on their plants and animals. I mean, what you just described is kind of disgusting, honestly. But I'm curious, you know, when farmers say, well, you know, what Joel does, it's too time consuming. It's too expensive. We just can't do that. And in a time, frankly, when the U.S. has too few farmers to merit counting on the national census form, you know, I mean, it's a real choice that a lot of these families, men and women, farmers have to make.
Well, I would say I would agree with you that it is a choice they make, but I don't think it's a choice they have to make. The fact is that we did not have a Manhattan Project for compost. We only had a Manhattan Project to develop explosives. And I realize I'm jumping here pretty quickly to a, and you can read about this in the book as I develop the historical context. But what's happened is the industrial, or I call it the mechanical food paradigm, essentially tries to mold farmers like me into some sort of a backwards barbarian Neanderthal Luddite. We want to go back to hog cholera, Newcastle disease in poultry, you know, brucellosis in cows, and undulant fever and bubonic plague. And the fact is that our biological side, the biological paradigm, you know, the scientific composting system brought to the world by Sir Albert Howard in 1943 at the height of World War II, that is no more old, if you will, than nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, chemical fertilization. And so our side, the biological side, certainly has not stood still during this period of time. And so today we have, I'm not a Luddite. I'm a believer in high-tech electric fencing and stainless steel and rural electrification and indoor plumbing and all these cool things that we have today. I mean, now we even have foliar fertilization using emulsified, you know, fish emulsion and compost tea being sprayed on with electromagnetic charges, beaming calypso music to make the stomatas open wide and swallow it in the leaf structure. I mean, this is biological farming, but it's very high-tech appreciation of the cell structure, the plant structure, and the tomatiness of the tomato and the pigness of the pig.
So what's your mission, Joel? What are you trying to do with this book and your movement? Are you trying to broaden the food movement's appeal in your direction, or what's your goal?
Well, I think on several levels, the first goal is that when people finish this book, they close it and say, wow, I've been sold a bill of goods. You know, I was told that Kraft Foods would take care of me. I was told Monsanto would take care of me. And you know what? They're not taking care of me. And in fact, you know, many American farmers aren't really taking care of me, and they're not taking care of the soil. They're not taking care of the invisible, you know, trillions of actinomycetes, earthworms, and mycorrhizae in the soil that are far more important than whether the Wall Street goes up and down. You know, our whole world lives and survives totally and utterly dependently on this invisible world of bacteria, fungi, microorganic beings that are the basis of all civilization, community, and survival. And so, and there are many people today, many people in the, you know, the corporate empire and the government research structures who think that we're such a clever civilization that for the first time in human history, we can extricate ourselves from the anchorage and the biological foundation of life. And I think that's a great big mistake. And in fact, it's showing up more and more with the, you know, with the problems we're having from everything with, you know, from DDT to chemical fertilization to, you know, transgenic modification. I mean, these things are creating huge problems, and it's because nature always bats last.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with organic livestock guru Joel Salatin this hour on farming the natural way. Just to give people an idea of your farm, Joel, I hope I got these numbers right, give or take a few, 30,000 dozen eggs, 100 head of cattle a year, 250 hogs, 800 turkeys, 600 rabbits, a smattering of blackberries and grapes and veggies and tree fruit. You do this all without insecticides and pesticides. You say you go beyond organic. And I want to ask you about the organic movement generally, because you say in the book you disdain the large-scale organic farms. You say they've compromised the movement's values. Explain that. What do you mean by that?
Well, what's happened is that there are now some, 150 synthetics allowed in organic certification. Once the government got involved with licensing organics, and if you'll, I will not say that I'm an organic farmer because I'm not, I haven't bought a license in order to use the term. So I can't say, that's why I say I'm beyond organic, because organic has become a system of just minimalistic don'ts in many cases. And this is why there are continuing to be class action suits. Cornucopia Institute has continued to, you know, sue the USDA routinely. Seems like there's a new one every quarter where the USDA does not enforce the standards against the biggest operators. It's a marketing technique that the government is now licensing, and whenever that happens, there's a compromise of the standards. And rather than being a minimalistic standard, what I want to do is espouse a broader philosophy, and so, you know, that's one reason why I don't, you know, use the term organic, and why, in fact, Michael Pollan in Omnivore's Dilemma, you know, deals with the whole organic issue when you start talking about government licenses.
So how do you know what's truly organic if you're shopping for that at the grocery store?
Well, first of all, you reduce shopping at the grocery store, and you unplug the television, you unplug all the iPods out of your kids' heads, and you say, "Hey, let's go on a food treasure hunt in our, you know, community this year." And so you cancel the Disney vacation, you let the jet fuel stay at home, and you start going on this wonderful food treasure hunt in your community, whether it's a community-supported agriculture, a farmer's market, a green market, a farm stand, go visit a farmer. The point is that we have the time, we have the energy. It's just, do we put a value on discovering what's available in our own backyards?
What about the cost of going local, Joel? I mean, so often, especially in these difficult economic times, you hear people talk about the high cost of eating organic. When people are cutting coupons, you know, it's hard to afford often, is it not?
Oh, sure. There's no question that this is, this is a more expensive price tag than what's in the grocery store. But you have to understand that the mechanical food paradigm, or the industrial food paradigm, however you want to discuss it. I try not to use industrial because that sounds like I'm opposed to scale, and I'm not opposed to scale. These things have to scale up as well as down. But anyway, the mechanical food paradigm externalizes much of its cost, the cost of pollution, the cost of the stench that surrounds the feedlots in Colorado and California and Iowa and the hog farms. I mean, that the water pollution that's caused by the manure lagoons that blow out and herbicide drift. There are huge externalized costs in the system that aren't accounted for in processed or mechanical food. Now, as far as the cost is concerned, I'd like to just play a little fun with you, and that is, I'm sure there are no listeners here on this program who would ever conceive of buying something that they don't need. I'm sure all the listening to us, Jane, are all only spending money on things that they really need. And so we won't talk about our listeners. We'll talk about all the people that aren't listening, all those people, them. And let's think about some things that people buy that they don't really need. I mean, I'm talking about soda, tobacco, alcohol, DiGiorno's frozen pizza, TV dinners, lottery tickets, Disney vacations, $100 designer jeans with holes already in the knees. I mean, there is a host of stuff that we buy that if we took that money and put it into our food, we could all eat like kings and probably have a much healthier, happier life.
Let me get a caller in here, Joel. Here's okay. David from Providence, Rhode Island. David, I know you want to join here. Welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, thank you, Jane. Uh-huh. Hi, Mr. Sellin. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I work with Blackbird Farm. It's a beef farm outside of Providence, about 10 minutes outside of Providence, about 45 minutes outside of Boston, so not exactly rural. We have 100 acres, cows, chickens, eggs, just got some pigs and lambs. So, complete agreement with what you're saying. I've seen it work. I know how the process works. We don't, obviously we're not a factory farm in any method, any means. We work exactly the way you describe. And I have two questions now, actually, because of what you just said. My question I wanted to ask, first of all, was what do you think about scale? Because we're always running into the issue that, we're selling out of all the beef we raise, regularly because it's fantastic meat. I'm proud of it. And the whole local food movement right now, people really want it. But my other question I wanted to ask, because of what you just said, is I very much tell people all the time the same thing you just said. You don't need that extra, video game or whatever. Spend some more money on the things you're actually putting inside your body to get better product. And the pushback that I often hear is, what America, that's what America's about. We want to, consume and buy the things that we want to buy to have fun and entertain. And I'm stymied sometimes as to how to respond to that. Obviously, I think it's important to put real good food into your bodies rather than stuff that could be, tainted or whatever. But it's a tough argument. And I'll take my answer off the air. I really appreciate hearing you talk today.
David, thank you. Jill Salatin.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, the answer to the folks that say, but this is what America's about, that's why I came up with this phrase, folks, this ain't normal. The point is that we've been sold this bill of goods, that we can be, for the first time in human history, this profoundly disconnected from our ecological umbilical, whether it's the soil, the food, our energy, our recreation, or whatever, that we can be so viscerally disconnected from real life that we can actually live a life of integrity otherwise. And my answer is you can't. You simply cannot be – You cannot abdicate the visceral ecological responsibility and culinary responsibility that people have exhibited throughout history and maintain a landscape of ecological integrity. It can't be done. And so – we have to understand summarily it will take individual responsibility and people stepping up to the plate and saying, you know what? I'm not going to be ignorant anymore. I'm not going to be disconnected anymore and build this relationship back.
Here's another call. I got to get to another one. Brian mm-hmm. in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Go ahead, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I was just when Joel mentioned that the farmers have a choice on how to farm, I just thought to myself that maybe, unfortunately, a lot of farmers are not smart enough to do what he does.
Okay, so it's fine for him, but maybe too complicated for the average farmer. I'm sure there are many who would take issue with that. But you have had great success, Joel. I mean, you have financially done well, and it sounds like clearly you've innovated on some things that aren't being done elsewhere. But a lot of farmers are struggling. And let me ask you about the subsidies that many farmers receive. They do need subsidies from the government to stay afloat. And I want to ask you, last month, President Obama proposed ending a direct payment subsidy that gives farmers about $5 billion a year as part of a larger effort to reduce the federal budget deficit. And I'm curious your response to that.
Well, my response is that disturbance is the underpinning of succession, of innovation. If you read any business book, all innovation requires periods of disturbance. And I would simply say that to say that farmers need subsidies is was simply incorrect. The fact is, I mean, New Zealand withdrew subsidies cold turkey in one fell swoop. About half the farmers went out of business, and today it's arguably they've just done extremely well while farmers went out of business. The fact is that there are tons and tons and tons of young people who are ready to come in as innovators. And so in times where the government needs to reduce some of its expenditures and quit subsidizing, corn and cotton and soybeans and things that actually encourage soil erosion, it's time to open up the opportunity. The farmers that don't want to change into new economic realities, that want to stay on the gravy train, well, they should just go out of business.
So many farmers, though.
There are lots of young farmers ready to step right up to the plate and take that. It's a disturbing innovation, but innovation is disturbing.
You think so? You think there are a lot of young people that are just ready to go and start that hard work and start the next generation of farmers? I mean, there are so many that have thrown in the towel. They just say it's too much. We can't survive. We actually need that government money. We can't do it without it.
Well, you won't see what I call the generation of new local connected, transparent farmers doing that. We've just right now in our family, we're going through our intern applications for next summer. We've got 8 spots, and we've got almost 100 applications in 2 weeks from young people that are wanting to become farmers. And they go everywhere from, research scientists, PhDs, to, one lady's over 300 employees at Bank of America. I mean, these are sharp people. And they say, I'm tired of the Dilbert cubicle. I'm tired of working for the man. I'm tired of working for, dead end, the cyber fantasy, virtual world cyberspace. And there is a host of people ready to take this up, and I say, bring them on, cut the supports, let the farmers that will adapt to this new economic reality make it. The ones that don't, and it opens up lots of opportunity for people that are ready to jump in and take on this new paradigm of locally sourced, transparent, biologically based, biomimic food systems.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation. Joel, here's Bob Stallman from Montgomery, Alabama. He's the president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, the nation's largest general farm organization. He's former president of the Texas Farm Bureau. He's also a Texas-based rice and cattle producer. Bob Stallman, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Well, hello, Jane. How are you?
So, you've just heard Joel's arguments. He's asking for an end to subsidies, no more chemicals, great family farming organically, beyond organic. Is it, it may be ideal, but is it realistic?
Well, I admire Joel for the system he's put together, the farming operation, the way he markets it. I mean, he's doing something that he believes in, and he's doing it very successfully, and I commend him for that. But, the reality is in America, the whole food system has evolved because consumers want certain choices, and they're willing to pay for those choices. And, whether you agree or disagree with those consumer choices in a marketplace, that's what drives our entire system. So, you know, consumers want those choices: local, organic, all natural, conventional, biotech, cage-free, free-range. Now, there's a lot of confusion about what all of that means for consumers, and frankly, farmers and ranchers today have started a dialogue to try to answer consumers' questions and listen to them and try to let them understand better all the different choices that are out there and how their food is raised and grown.
Have you seen subsidized farmers jump ship, go natural? Have you seen farmers flip their business models and turn away from the chemicals, turn away from the government subsidies and make it work? I mean, can't we, shouldn't we make it worth their while to do so?
Well, the farm policy safety net system that's been in place in this country since the Depression era has served a purpose. It's been a specific purpose. It's been a targeted purpose. And frankly, I'll be honest with you, given the budget and fiscal situation this country is in, there's going to be a lot fewer of those dollars devoted to that safety net. And farmers and ranchers understand that. And I see farmers and ranchers preparing for that day when it happens. And yet, there still will be a transitional issue and how difficult it is for some particularly, but we'll work our way through that. At the end of the day, though, the multiple choices that exist out there for consumers are very important, and every system has pros and cons. And those pros and cons, I think, consumers should have a better understanding of as they go into the grocery store or their markets and make their choices as to the food they want to eat.
Joel says it's absolutely necessary to make some of these changes, to move in his direction. 1,500 miles between field and fork is not a sustainable idea, you know, if we want our grandchildren to be healthy in generations to come. What's your response?
Well, I don't believe that. I mean, sustainability, you know, that's one of those definitional things for, you know, which there isn't much of a definition at this point. The reality is the food system has evolved to the point where, you know, consumers have the ability now to have healthy and safe food. They want convenience. They want shelf life. They want year-round access to products that weren't available before the advent of modern processing, packaging, transportation. That's what consumers have indicated they want. Now, I don't think I'm going to be in a position to tell consumers what they absolutely should have or tell them that there's only one true and right way to raise and grow that food that they eat. Once again, we think consumers have a role in that, and the consumer's role is to determine what they want to spend their dollars on.
And I think Joel's point is consumers don't actually know what is going into their food. They don't know how it's being grown. They don't know, that they can't pronounce half of what they're eating. Your response?
Well, I would actually agree with that. The U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, which is a group of 55 farmer and rancher-led groups representing most of the farmers in this country, have gotten together to create the food dialogues. In that process, we did a survey, and it's amazing. Consumers admit that, 72% of them don't really know much about how their food is raised or grown. And so there's a knowledge gap there, and it's a great opportunity for farmers and ranchers to directly connect with consumers and answer those questions and, tell them about the details about how their food is raised and grown. Tell them about the choices in each production system that's out there. And then let consumers make their choice in the marketplace, and those choices will drive what happens in terms of how farmers and ranchers grow and raise food.
Very quickly, Bob, do you agree with Joel? Do you see a new young generation of farmers anxious to get their hands dirty and get in this field of work?
Well, I tell you, every year we have a big conference with about 800 to 1,000 young farmers and ranchers that are just energetic, they're gung-ho, they're ready to go. They're doing things differently than their fathers and grandfathers, but yes, I see a lot of energy out there, and there are a lot of young individuals that are ready to go.
Bob Stallman, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're discussing America's farming future and the battle over organics, among other things. Can America afford to lose the chemicals, lose the subsidies? We'll be back after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
They never want to see a rake or a plow, and who the deuce can parlez-vous a cow? And how you gonna keep on down on the farm after they seen Paris?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with farmer Joel Salatin on how to grow up, as he calls it, quote, the normal way, going back to the land. Let's go right to the phones and to Owensboro, Kentucky. Jesse is on the line. Hi, Jesse. I'm glad you waited. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Jane. I appreciate you taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say hi to Joel and say that I appreciate the work he's doing to educate the public on where our food comes from. And I think he's got a fantastic business model. the problem that I have, Joel, is that I'm a young farmer that you speak about, and I assure you that I'm an innovative guy. Most of us are college educated these days, and we're looking for a better way. But, sir, I don't believe you have it. If every single one of us were doing business the way that you were, this country would surely starve. I've got an appreciation for the work you do, as I say, but, you know, I must disagree with you strongly on many of your points, specifically regarding subsidies. I mean, agricultural subsidies protect the consumer. This is one of the only industries in the world where we don't get to set our price. Now, Joel, you probably do set the price on many of your products, but as a guy who's out here growing corn, soybeans, and wheat, I don't get to say this is what I want to charge for my product. And agricultural subsidies protect the consumer in keeping our food prices low, the lowest in the world. I think we're still about 13% of average income is what we're paying for our food. And you know, I think you make some good points about health and what you the products that you're able to offer may or may not be better, but there's no scientific proof of that. There's not any evidence at all that genetically modified crops have caused any type of health issue. And I appreciate some of the things you're saying on the livestock side. I definitely agree with you there. But, you know, as far as producing the grains that feed this country and the rest of the world, I really don't see that your model can work. I'd like to find a better way. I'm not sure that we've got it where it needs to be right now. But, man, I really don't appreciate being demonized by the guys in the slow food movement. And I'd
Jesse,
like
stay on the line and let me ask Joel to respond to all that. Thanks for calling. Go ahead, Joel.
I've been taking notes, and it's a lot to respond to. First of all, let me just say that transgenic modification creates brand new life forms, and in this book, I have a whole chapter about the fact that I'm sure Jesse, you are an avid defender of private property rights. And so I would just ask, how in the world can you defend somebody like Monsanto, who creates brand new life forms that nature has a huge number of barriers from ever being created in the first place, and send those off in a sexual orgy across my fields to impregnate my crops with their life forms, and then has the audacity to get the U.S. courts to say that I owe them a royalty for patent infringement because I used their slaves on my farm when I didn't want them to be there in the first place. This is as anti-American as you can imagine. It's not only wrong, it's immoral, it's unethical. Whether or not there's a harm to genetically modified organisms, the fact is you can't keep them home. And so they run rampant around, you know, creating new life forms that somebody else may or may not want.
Jesse, jump in and respond to what you hear Joel saying.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not pro-Monsanto. Let's just get specific and talk about Roundup Ready soybeans. I mean, it's unreal how that innovation has revolutionized our ability to produce more bushels of soybeans with less chemical use. I mean, Roundup is certainly has its problems, but as far as toxicity is concerned, there's not a better system out there. I mean, salt is more toxic than Roundup, Joel. And I don't agree with a lot of Monsanto's business practices, and I certainly understand that if you're non-GMO, you don't want my soybeans flying over into your field. But, you know, that's what we create barriers for.
What barriers? Where's
how in a 50-foot strip in your field? I mean, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, but this stuff goes on the jet stream.
Our neighbors down here, Joel. I know what my neighbors are planting, and if I have non-GMO soybeans, which I can't have a single sample out of my truck test positive for GMO, then I've got to do what it takes to protect my field. And if that means putting in a grass strip barrier, then that's what I need to do. But good farmers have to be good neighbors as well and know what's happening around them. So,
Joel, go ahead.
I don't agree with that argument.
Well, I don't call it a good neighbor when a neighbor plants something that jumps my fences and, in fact, even goes on the jet streams to other continents and impregnates other people's maize and already is creating, you know, a big weed problems. We've already lost the Bacillus thuringiensis biological to GMOs. you know, there are 67 now worldwide studies in the last year indicting the efficacy and the performance of GMOs, all the claims. Here's the point. The one of the points that I make in the book is about paradigms. And it's hard to argue, you know, point for point with somebody like this because our paradigm overwhelms our, you know, our science. When you come off as saying, well, you know, America's going to starve, you know, if everybody grew like us. You know, without us planting a seed or a bag of chemical fertilizer in 50 years, our farm produces five times as much beef per acre as any farm in our county. Now, that's using biological principles. Biological principles always, always outcompete egocentric hubris. And the fact is that most people are not willing to look honestly at the other side. We become entrenched, and so we defend. You know, subsidies protect the consumer. Subsidies aren't protecting the consumer. We've got consumers now in our country that lead the world in five of the most chronic illnesses, from type 2 diabetes to premature births, obesity, leukemia, cancer. Yes, that's what our cheap food policy has given us. So I don't call that a very normal kind of way to live. I don't call that a very protective of the consumer. And so there are just a lot of broad brushes here that problems.
Let me thank Jesse for calling and for that exchange, and we're going to move on to another point with Kathy in Forestville, Virginia. Kathy, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing? Let's see. I want to hurry up and get through this. I have a couple of comments and a question. I do want to talk about, we do have a little small farmette in Shenandoah County.
Okay.
In Virginia, mm-hmm. And close to, you know.
Joel, uh-huh.
You know, at the farms. And yep. There's lots of local, you know, and organic farms in the area. We try to grow as organically as we can. We do. We let the bugs eat part of our crops. comment, though, is we have started this little experiment with planting in 5-gallon buckets. So people in homes and apartments that don't have yards, it's going very well. We've got tomatoes and herbs and, you know, not corn or anything huge, but, you know, small plants are growing in our 5-gallon buckets. So there's no excuse for not to grow your own food. You can do,
sure.
You can do cucumbers and squash and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, well, container gardening is absolutely a wonderful way for urbanites to have a visceral connection with food, and I strongly advise it. I mean, it's all a part of an edible landscaping procedure. Absolutely,
it did make the front yard look good too.
Kathy, my screener says you have a question about chickens too.
Yes, I do. We have, you know, our chickens are running around and loose, and we get, you know, eggs during the summer and a couple during the winter. My question is, though, they're tough as leather when you try to eat them. How can I cook one of these chickens where it's not going to bounce off my teeth? I know we can boil it forever, but, you know, any other ideas?
Are these, okay, my question for you, are these chickens, are these young broiler chickens, or are these like egg layers?
They're egg layers.
Oh, okay.
And
they're from
a farm up in Basie, so they're from all around the world. So, you know, they're not like, okay, this chicken's for eating. They're just chickens.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that they're
breed and
all right,
yeah,
Kathy,
old.
Joel, what do you think?
Yeah, well, these are older birds. These are more like stewing hens, and older birds can't be fast cooked. I mean, old chicken and dumplings, they got to be slow cooked because their muscle tissue, their connective tissue becomes more more pronounced. And so all the different animals have different cooking techniques based on, you know, their production and the physiology of the critter. And so that's just something you can't just fast cook everything that comes down the pike.
All right.
That's what slow cookers and crock pots and things like that are for.
Some comments from our website. Here's one from Just Sayin, who says, farming and farm work puts the real in the reality of life and death. I feel fortunate to have had farming as a basis for viewing the world around me. Here's Terry Tree, who says promoting the honest feeling of doing something that makes your own life and comfort better is something that children will eat up, pun intended. Joel Salatin has changed my son's life. At age 25, he's taking the risk of starting his own grass-fed beef operation in Vermont. And Alex says, if I ate meat, I would eat happy animals like those at Polyface Farm. Here's another caller from Quebec, Canada. Here's Diana. Hi, Diana. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Joel. I actually agree with a lot of what Joel has said about local food and raising your own. We do have the ability at our house. Luckily, we have 190 acres. We raise chickens and goats and sheep and all sorts of our own vegetables and fruits. I do feel it's difficult, though, to kind of apply this broadly. I think that people get caught up in this notion that it's an all-or-nothing proposition, whereas we really all can do something. I think it's a definite fallacy that we should be all, it's almost impossible, especially in our northern climate, to eat everything local and everything grass-fed. I know we do have to feed hay and some supplements in the wintertime, but I just think let people realize that there are small steps to take gradually to get yourself there.
Diana, thank you. Here's Sid from Montpelier, Vermont. Hi, Sid. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Joel. I was actually sitting in the cab of a loader turning a compost pile. I work for and have grown up living at Vermont Compost Company, and it's my father's business. And so at this, you know, at this company, I run into a lot of organic growers, and we provide them with mixes to do a lot of their work. And I agree with a lot of, with almost everything Joel has been saying. And I disagree with one of your callers saying that, you know, incentives are to protect the consumer, in that I think we really do need to shift our paradigm, as Joel was saying, and that it's not, most people don't actually see the real cost in the food they're buying, both to their health and to the environment we live in. I think that the hardest thing that we need to come up with is realistic ways to apply sustainable practices and living within our solar means to the broader economy and our culture, especially as we move closer to an urban society. So I am kind of wondering what Joel thinks about how we can get politicians to realize that the food we eat and the systems we put in place to produce the food we eat are really fundamentally important, and we can no longer just look at it as a monetary basis based on our use of fossil fuels. I think I would like to hear Joel's thoughts on how to implement this.
All right, let's hear him. Joel, thank you. Sid, appreciate your call.
Well, yeah, that's a great question, Sid. And, you know, if I had an answer, if I could snap my thumbs and make all the politicians realize that we're living in abnormal times, you know, I would do it. But the fact is that all great movements that have stood the test of time start from the grassroots, just like you're doing it at the Vermont Compost Company. I know you, and my hat, I salute you. And it's that type of activity, one person at a time. And I couldn't agree more with the lady from Diana from Quebec. Yes, it is all about doing one little thing at a time, and the cumulative effect of doing lots of little things is how all great innovation and great broad-based things that actually stand the test of time occur. And so this is not going to be a top-down change. It's going to be a bottom-up as we empower people to put solariums on their houses, get in touch with their local food system, and build this from the bottom up.
Let me squeeze in Karen from Broadway, Virginia. Hi, Karen. Glad you waited. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Jane. Hi, Joel.
Hi.
I live in Broadway, just north of your farm, and
yes.
I had the privilege of attending one of your tours, going on one of your tours a few years ago. I really enjoyed it. Got to meet your wife, your sons, who all help you out so much,
mm-hmm.
and the food was great. So thanks. I do want to say, though, that I haven't been able to purchase your chicken or your eggs because, as I understand it, that you mentioned on your farm when I asked you, you feed your chickens a commercial feed which contains fish meal, ground up fish. And my understanding is that fish meal is high in mercury content. And I'm very sensitive to that. So I'm wondering if you could comment on, I'd like to know if you still feed your chicken's feed, which contains fish meal.
All right, Karen, we don't have much time. I appreciate your call. Joe, go ahead quickly.
Yes, there are different kinds of fish meals, and this is Menhaden. It's Omri Organic Certified out of Pennsylvania by Fertrell. And all I can say is that, again, there are fish meals and there are fish meals. And so we feed very, very little of it. But for these high-performance broiler chickens, it is one way to get them enough octane to put on the broad breasts that customers so want.
So wrap us up here after this hour of a lot of information, a lot going on here. But tell us how we can get back to your view of what's normal, a normal life, of the way we used to be, of understanding where our food comes from and how we get it and what's best for us. What's the first thing to do? What's the first step?
Well, I think the first step is to get in your kitchen. And surround yourself with your kids. You know, you can do fractions, you can do chemistry, all sorts of cool stuff in kitchens. So get in your kitchen. You know, you don't have to drive 500 miles to go to a soccer game. You can make the home the center of your activity instead of just a pit stop between everything that's important in life. Number two, take your recreational and entertainment budget and get in touch with your food system in your local economy. Number three, begin to preserve and make your own larder, your own supermarket in your own house.
Joel Salatin, the book is Folks, This Ain't Normal. Appreciate your time today, Joel. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane, for having me.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.